Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
I'm John Batchelor. The New World Report. I welcome Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College. He has been traveling for some weeks. It's good to have him back in the USA. However, we're going to attend to countries that we've not been able to cover for some time because of the emergencies in Venezuela and Brazil, etc. Most recently, the professor was in Chile. We begin, however, with Ecuador. Evan, a very good evening to you. Ecuador, the last time we discussed it, I believe, it was at the time of the election, and Mr. Noboa, who had been the president, visited Mar-a-Lago before his election, and that turned out to be a positive. He won handily. He's young. He's the son of a well-to-do rancher, I believe. And in any event, he's young and energetic and has been moving Ecuador very carefully away from its dependence on organized crime, let's put it that way. And I've not seen alarming reports from Ecuador for some time, which is why we marched to the sound of gunfire. However, you tell me Mr. Noboa is in China. Why, and what is he hoping to achieve, and what is the state of Ecuador these days? Good evening to you.
Good evening to you, John. For Ecuadorians, one of the major news items this week is Daniel Noboa's state visit, including a conversation that he had with China's President Xi Jinping on the 18th of August. Seven agreements came out of that, although some of the details are not fully transparent. But some of the more interesting include the Chinese donation of 125 patrol vehicles, probably mostly for the Ecuadorian police and military, as well as medical equipment and various other items. There's a talk of donating a AI-based weather forecasting system, which probably raises some significant information security concerns if it's allowed to tap into the Ecuadorian weather system in general, as well as continued work on hydroelectric projects such as the problematic Coca-Cola-Sinclair Dam, donation of solar panels, and a curious agreement between China Media Group and the Ecuadorian presidency, probably for supplying information about what's going on in China, but perhaps with the opportunity to influence the Ecuadorian leadership going forward. So this is similar to what we've seen in other places like Jose Antonio Kast in Chile, as well as even Javier Milei in China, where there is a political desire to be aligned with Washington on security issues and at least publicly support the U.S. initiative such as the Shield of the Americas, hoping that that creates enough space to be able to get the goodies that they need from China economically. Certainly, China has a powerful presence in Ecuador's mining sector, especially in the south, where they've been there for about 15 years. They've got an important presence in the oil sector as well as consumer products and other things. And so the argument that my Ecuadorian colleagues made is that Noboa understands that although he has a significant security crisis that's ongoing, the military is pretty much at its limits in terms of what they can do to contain some of these Ecuadorian violent groups. And so Noboa understands that having security cooperation with the U.S. is not enough, that really if he doesn't continue to get the economic benefits from China to deliver, he is going to politically and more strategically have a problem just as he tries to manage the challenges that Ecuador faces.
My memory is that Ecuador was a huge mystery and problem during the Biden administration because it was an entry point from China of young men of draft age, big shoulders, very handsome, who had no English whatsoever. I remember one incident at the edge of the Darien Gap. There were two or three camps that had been improved by money from Homeland Security. And a young man came up to my correspondent and asked, using his iPhone because he had no English. So he said into the iPhone what he wanted, and the iPhone said which way to, and he named the name of a camp to travel to. So he knew where he was supposed to go, but he had no English. He was just coming out of the Darien Gap, which is a dangerous enough passageway, although he looked vigorous. He's young. And my correspondent gave him directions, and he marched off happily. And we talked about that afterwards. I said, what is that? I don't know what it is. And it turned out, with a little more investigation, there were actually Chinese hotels in Ecuador as part of a gathering place for busing them into Colombia, across Colombia to the Darien Gap entry, and then crossing into, well, Central America on their way to America. I don't know the number. I don't know why or how they were organized, but it was a puzzle to us then. So I ask now, given that Noboa is in China, what was that? What were they for? Why was Ecuador cooperating, and why did China want its draft-age males hiking into America?
Well, John, one of the things that that's a reminder of is the fact that Ecuador is a Pacific-facing nation, and thus its ties to China and its ties to the Pacific in general have been important. We often focus more on Chile and Peru and their Pacific ties, but Ecuador sees itself and understands it to be part of the Pacific as well. We've actually seen that in an organized crime sense. In, for example, when Colombia had an overflow of cocaine production, and it couldn't get out quickly enough through Venezuela or through the Colombian coast. Cocaine from Colombia started flowing out through Ecuador's Pacific coast and then to Europe and Oceania. Now, that same thing has also tied Ecuador both commercially but also in migration patterns to the PRC. There has long been a modest Chinese community in places like Quevedo, as well as in Guayaquil. What you saw going all the way back to the days of populist President Rafael Correa in about 2005, 2006, is that when Ecuador wanted to promote Chinese investment, it dropped visa requirements for Chinese nationals. And that created a big problem. Because Chinese nationals that couldn't come into Colombia without a visa and travel north through the traditional route started coming in through Ecuador. I've actually stayed in those what used to be $25 a night hotels that were reasonably clean but not great services and seen those mysterious groups of Chinese. And so what was happening for a while is you were getting just loads of Chinese coming in through Ecuador, getting on buses, very organized activities going up through Colombia. The old Colombian intelligence services, the DAS, used to just stop busloads of Chinese coming up through their country. And then, of course, in the 2023-2024 period, those same routes continued and were used to bring Chinese in, then going up through the Darien Gap and all the way eventually up through Mexico and to the U.S. Southern border. You alluded to the concerns over unregistered military age males. Probably there are high unemployment rates in China, especially in the past 2 to 3 years with the financial collapse and the real estate collapse. And so most of those military male age males were probably people who could not get employment in China. But it's unthinkable that the very capable People's Liberation Army and intelligence services, the MSS, wouldn't have taken advantage of those flows. It was estimated 30,000 military-aged Chinese males in 2024 alone going up through those border crossings. But at least some of them were not plans by the MSS or PLA to be able to get into the United States unregistered. And so Ecuador, it's a reminder that both in commerce and also illicit activity, that that China's connection and Ecuador's looking to the Pacific has long been important.
Is there a Chinese Chinatown in Quito the way there has been in other capitals dating from before the 21st century, the 19th and 20th century, large number of in the diaspora?
There is, John. It's not quite as big as the Chinese community in Peru. As a matter of fact, the history of it is during the collapse of the Qing dynasty at the end of the 19th century and into the early 20th century. You had lots of very marginalized Chinese who were coming over principally to Lima, Peru, because that was kind of one of the centers of the old Spanish civilization, but extending down into what's today the north of Chile, the Atacama Desert. So you have a serious Chinese community there who used to be involved in the guano trade and extending all the way up into Ecuador. And so my Ecuadorian friends in Guayaquil used to tell me stories that the Chinese community is very well organized in Guayaquil, that the Chinese would come in and essentially the community organizations would say, okay, you want to be a restaurant owner? You want to be a farmer? So if they said, okay, restaurant owner, okay, here's a little bit of seed capital, pay us back for this, set up your restaurant here in Guayaquil. If you want to be a farmer, okay, here's a little bit of capital, we'll send you up to Quevedo and we'll set you up there. So to this day, there are small but important Chinese communities, as well as that Chinatown that goes back to those flows that date all the way back to the late 19th century and the collapse of the last Chinese dynasty.
I'm speaking with Professor Evan Ellis, the U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute. New World Report. We're headed to Bolivia. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with my good colleague, Professor Evan Ellis, who recently was in Bolivia, and we're going there now because there's a headline at Reuters, unusual, but it looks like the crisis in Bolivia continues in a new direction. You will recall Bolivia has been hectored by so-called strikes for some time now, closing down at one point the capital city. Strikes that were emphasized were union men, were miners, but in fact, there was a large reason to believe it was organized by Evo Morales, the sinister former president who floats around in the Americas like an angel of death. Right now, however, it looks like we're going to a political crisis. The headline in Reuters, Bolivia lawmakers likely force economy minister's removal in setbacks for President Paz. Well, at least it's not a blockade, but this probably proceeds from the shaky year that Bolivia's had. Is this a threat to Paz's election or Paz's ability, Professor?
Well, John, this is something that we talked about during the Bolivia crisis itself, and some of the deals that President Paz made to survive the crisis a couple months ago, including commitments for greater spending and commitments to ease off of some laws that he was trying to push through to have greater fiscal discipline. Some of those deals that he made, including with some of the powerful unions in Bolivia, and the fact that Evo Morales is still not in jail. He still continues in his Cocalero holdup in the Chapare region. The sense was that these deals got you through the first crisis, but over the long term, we're probably going to have a larger and more significant crisis for Rodrigo Paz before the end of the year. And so there is the issue of the economy minister, but in addition to that, one of his closest advisors, an Argentine by the name of Fernando Saramejo, lots of speculation when I was there in Bolivia of the nature of the influence that he had. He had supported Paz's candidacy and has a media organization. And the question is, how this Argentine have so much influence? A lot of whispering of corruption ties that included, perhaps access to Washington, D.C., but you're going back to Argentina and even perhaps the Milei government itself. Part of this drama also was that a Bolivian lawyer by the name of Nadia Beller, who was seen as perhaps the romantic partner of Saramejo, but some people suggested that she had ties to Cuban intelligence, was all tied into this. And so it was a very complex plot. And so what's happened in recent weeks, apart from some of the economic issues, is that Saramejo has been arrested for what appears to be a domestic violence affair. It appears that there was a what appears to be have been an attack on Beller, armed men coming up to her dressed as food delivery drivers. Apparently, she took four shots, but somehow taking those four shots at close proximity, none of them went into any serious organs, and so she survived. So some of the more cynical in Bolivia say that this was staged, and she is now talking about allegedly Cermejo being involved with the U.S. CIA and various corruption plots. And so there's some question of, will this incident be used to highlight perceived or real high-level corruption, and will those perceptions of corruption, if the scandal grows, have kind of the launching point of the next political crisis because of these other things that everyone is expecting that Paz will have to face before the end of the year. And so it's a bit of a soap opera drama right now, but one that actually has the potential to kick off a more serious political crisis towards the end of the year in Bolivia.
Answering the question, who benefits from turmoil in the capital city, the number one and two and three suspect would be Evo Morales. Where is he?
Evo Morales continues to be holed up in his coca-producing region, the Chapare, surrounded by his supporters. Paz never was able to actually muster the operation to actually go after him, even though by Bolivian courts, he is a fugitive from Bolivian justice. As a matter of fact, one of the accusations was that supposedly Cermejo was coordinating on a supposed operation supported by the U.S. To go after Morales. But Morales remains holed up there. But you also have his connection with organized crime, including Brazilian criminal groups such as the First Capital Command and the Red Command. We can remember that one of the big narco-traffickers, Sebastian Marcet, just a couple of months ago was arrested in Santa Cruz, Bolivia, where he'd been openly living and running operations from there. And so, that's the other big question, the interaction between Evo Morales, international cocaine traffickers. And then the other big group that benefits from this, frankly, is the Cubans, because if the Cubans, former Cuban agent Manuel Rocha, helped to bring the Evo Morales government into power, if Cuban agents are able to destabilize the Paz government, that weakens the U.S. ability to turn Bolivia into a cooperative security partner and returns it to narco-fueled chaos.
The situation then in Chile, it remains fragile. Is that a fair summary right now? Paz is nowhere near confident.
It's stable but fragile in Bolivia right now with the Paz government. He, again, continues to be a cooperative security partner of the U.S. with the DEA and other security organizations trying to build a presence there to try to get some of the narco-trafficking situation under control. But the question is, in terms of some of the fiscal challenges and economic challenges that Bolivia faces, as well as the confidence of his ministers in his own kind of the perceived lack of decisiveness of his leadership, plus essentially all of his enemies are still in place and coordinating and apparently sharpening knives to bring him down for, again, what could be a crisis that accelerates in the second half of the year.
Professor Avenales, U.S. Army War College. Chile, where the professor has recently visited, is not a bad story, but I want to catch up on it. We're headed to Santiago. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. Professor Avenales, the U.S. Army War College, is here for the New World Report. Recently spent some days in Santiago, Chile. I'm always excited to hear about Chile because it has the Atacama Desert, the driest place on the Earth, previously understood to be the driest place on the Earth, where all the big astronomers had to hang out with all the big new gadgets they call telescopes. There's one being built right now, the very, 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 very large European telescope, which a colleague of mine in these last hours said is necessary for them to turn it on the little red dots of the cosmic dawn. That's how important Chile is. What is John talking about? Cosmic dawn, that's the beginning. At least if you believe in chronology, which I'm told is not really useful when you're doing cosmology because time is a thing. It's not permanent through the universe. In any event, cosmic dawn, the first billion years, and the closest we've come so far to the Big Bang is 280 million years, a galaxy that we found there. And then there are the little red dots. No time to go into this other than to say that part of the solution to the little red dots and confirmation of that solution is going to need the Atacama Desert, which is why I get excited when we go to Chile. Professor, forgive me for the detour. It's sort of like a little bird drops in front of me and I have to get excited about Chile because it has the tools we know to solve some of the beginning. Santiago gave you no difficulty, and as I recall, things are running as normal. Is that news?
Chile has really, since the Pinochet era, the dictatorship and the controversy that implied, but one of the gifts of Chile's dictatorship has long been good governance and economic prosperity based on a laissez-faire economic concept. The bringing in of the famous Chicago boys of neoclassical economics. But aside from Chile's good governance, and of course, we can talk about some of the problems that Paz continues to face with his security and economic agenda, but also, as you allude to, the Atacama Desert in the north of Chile is considered some of the best astronomical conditions because of its traditional very arid climate. So that gives you a lack of atmospheric distortion. But recently, because of the El Nino phenomenon, which has really made most of the Pacific coast of South America much wetter, and that's getting more intense. In the northern part of Chile, as well as in Ecuador and in Peru, you're seeing this increased humidity. And so literally this week, you had thunderstorms in the Atacama Desert, a place that sometimes would go the entire year without registering any rainfall at all. And this week you had thunderstorms in that the driest of the dry desert. And so there is some question of how that may impact mining operations in Chile and other things, as well as impacting the rest of the region. With respect to some of the security challenges, again, one of the things that brought José Antonio Kast to power was frustration over gangs and extortion, especially some of the flows of people coming in from Chile's northern border with Peru and in Bolivia. And so from day one, Kast began rolling out a new initiative to physically close off the border with a series of trenches and walls. Those are in progress, but thus far incomplete. In addition to that, Kast rolled out a new security package, which is mostly still talk about the legislation that he will implement rather than actual legislation that has been passed. But you do have some talk of, for example, having increased presence by the Chilean military to complement the police, the Carabineros in some of the most dangerous neighborhoods, some talk about increasing penalties for gang membership, some help with the government in seizing assets of these groups, some talks about easing up of rules that restrict the ability of the police in these various neighborhoods to use force, and some possibility to be easier to declare states of emergency. So there are a number of different things that are kind of on the table. There are probably limits to the resources that the military has and some concerns about the legal authorities to bring the military into these things. But certainly Kast is pressing that forward. But again, still relatively early to say that there have been results to this. And of course, the other issue is his economic plan. So that was the first major piece of legislation he rolled out. Again, it's still in its early stages. Chile's economy has actually been growing at a decent rate, about 2.4%. They have record copper prices, six, maybe going to $7 a pound, which again has helped bring more money into the Chilean coffers. Although the Chilean copper organization itself, Codelco, has some pretty severe problems with its production and debt and things like that, that actually caused Kast to say, we need the money from Codelco, but you keep your earnings this year. And so really what we're seeing is in the early stages of the broad security response, the early stages of the broad economic package response, which will lower taxes and bring kind of laissez-faire economics back. A reminder that Chile, like the rest of the region, is also impacted by natural phenomena such as the El Nino phenomenon that we're seeing.
We leave then Chile and head to the phenomena of earthquakes. Colombia, De La Espria, within days of his inauguration, earthquake, very damaging earthquake, hit southern Colombia. I've seen pictures of collapsed buildings, which seem to be routine when these places that have earthquake in their background do not build according to recommendations for earthquake zones. That's happened in Colombia now as well. De La Espria is making vigorous statements from Bogota, giving an estimate of how much it's going to cost to repair. In any event, this happened all of a sudden after he'd made it very clear that the theme of his administration, he cannot be reelected, is security. Has he been set back by the earthquake? There are only so many resources in Bogota.
Well, John, in the long range, it's probably a rough start for De La Espria. So first of all, the 7.4 magnitude earthquake, this was the biggest earthquake in Colombia in a century. And so just the magnitude of it, it occurred in a part of the country where geologically it caused it to have pretty widespread damage. And so almost the entire kind of from the coast, the southwest in Chocó, places like that, especially the traditional, very beautiful coffee growing region was badly damaged. So immediately, De La Espria had just come into office. This was his first big challenge. There was some controversy because he was reluctant to let the helpers from the Mexican different volunteer authorities come in who had certain expertise in responding in the first 72 hours. By the time he allowed them to come in, that window for saving lives had passed. So it's estimated that 300 plus lives that were lost in this tragedy. In some ways, it cast some aspersions on the controversial orientation of De La Espria. But on the other hand, when we look at this security agenda more broadly, for which the earthquake is only a short-term distraction. He is moving forward in a very significant new way to stop the negotiations with various criminal groups that had caused the number of people associated with those groups to literally double to 25,000 under the previous president, Gustavo Petro. He's promising to use aerial spraying and manual eradication and other things to try to get coca production under control, which had again exploded under his predecessor from 40,000 hectares to over 300,000 hectares under cultivation. He's talking about actively working with the United States. In the recent military meeting at the end of the Panamax exercise in Panama just a couple of days ago, the Colombian, the defense minister, Jorge Mora, and the Colombian government signed a series of agreements with the United States to be able to do more cooperation on intelligence and maybe even joint operations. Colombia is even actually buying some what are called MQ-9s, Predator drones that actually could be used to do aerial-based strikes, such as the type of strikes that the U.S. used to do against Al-Qaeda in the Middle East. And, of course, De La Espria himself has announced active cooperation, Colombia working with the United States and others as part of the America's Counter-Cartel Coalition. So I think certainly what you're seeing in the security domain is a big change in the posture of Colombia, really returning to its previous aggressive posture against those arms groups to try to get that violence and criminality under control. So certainly the start with the tragic earthquake was a bit of a rough patch for De La Espria. Raised some red flags about perhaps his very controversial, combative style of governance. But it appears in terms of security and cooperation with the U.S. that Colombia is off to a good start and will probably be moving quickly to go after armed groups. And we'll see to what degree that can have concrete success in this very difficult challenge in security that Colombia faces.
Professor Avenelis, U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute, The New World Report. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor, The New World Report, Professor Avenelis, U.S. Army War College, the earthquake in Colombia, and now the earthquakes in Venezuela. The regime in Venezuela is untrustworthy, contemptible, and led by the Rodriguez brother and sister. At the same time, they are the provisional government, and therefore the Trump administration has recommended the opposition, not Machado's opposition, the opposition that is made up of the last legitimately elected legislature, begin conversation about transfer of authority from the gangsters of the palace, the Rodriguezes and their allies, into the hands of a legitimately elected president, which there is one. But in any event, the conversation is with a young woman named Dinara Vergara, who was the leader of the assembly, legitimately elected once upon a time. Those conversations started over these last weeks. Professor, any progress in getting closer to an election date? And what does this mean about the recovery from the earthquake, where there have been lots of doubts about the Rodriguez brother and sister?
Well, John, there's certainly no commitment to any specific election date or the structures that would bring about an election, although there does seem to be some limited progress in these negotiations between the head of the previously legitimate Venezuelan Congress, who's a current leader, as you note, is Dinara Figuera, and the new essentially Chavista-fabricated assembly, which is headed by Delcy Rodriguez's brother, Jorge Rodriguez. In those, there's some agreement to agree or cooperate on at least getting a new Supreme Court, which was considered rigged in the process of being more rigged previously by the Chavistas. Some agreement on judicial reform, although details yet to be specified. Some agreement on working together on earthquake reconstruction and maybe trying to get Venezuela's gold back, which is being has been seized by the Bank of England because, of course, Great Britain, going back to the time when we imposed sanctions under the first Trump administration, recognizes that this government of the Chavistas is illegitimate, and so who controls that $4 billion of Venezuelan gold being held by the Bank of England, and then, of course, some coordination on reconstruction. So there's some signs of progress that baby steps are being taken. One does, though, remind oneself of some of those talking that happened under the Biden administration with the former former National Security Advisor Juan Gonzalez, when, again, sometimes the running out the clock and dragging out the process gave the illusions of working towards democracy without real concrete steps. And so it's, as you note, very important for Venezuela to get towards some actual reliable elections and a restoration of what is seen as a democratically legitimate government and rule of law. And again, there's a bit of a dystopian sense because technically Venezuela has a legitimate government. We often keep forgetting that in these negotiations. They were elected. It was Edmundo Gonzalez with his designated vice president, Maria Corina Machado, elected July 28, 2024 by an overwhelming portion of the population, almost a 2-to-1 ratio over Nicolas Maduro. So the de jure legitimate president continues to be sidelined, ironically, from talks about what the future of the country will be in lieu of the also legitimate, but certainly not the elected president, Dinara Figuera.
My concern also about Venezuela is that the prisoners in the cells have remained, the political prisoners have remained through the government, which is the thing you check off saying, are they cooperating? No, they're brutes, and they continue to be brutes. Is there any talk about that in Washington?
Well, the numbers that you see, there's a suggestion by a watchdog organization called Foro Penal that suggests that almost 400 people continue to be political prisoners. There was recently a release of what the government claimed were 131 people. Some other groups say maybe it was only 100. So you have a trickle of people being allowed out. And of course, you have had a change in laws, which supposedly said we'll pardon these people if they admit their crimes. But they'll continue to have to be under house arrest or other conditions that doesn't actually recognize that the things that they were put in jail for, which were basically political opposition, still continue to be crimes in Venezuela. So there's some illusion of progress. And oftentimes those little concessions are used to buy time or give the illusion of democratic opening. But the Venezuelan intelligence organization, SEBIN, continues to be there. The colectivos, basically the gangs of thugs, which are often used by government, the Chavistas, to control Venezuelan neighborhoods, are still there. Of course, the other structures are there. Some word that, the Cubans have been rooted out to some degree. But, all of the structures of repression of the Venezuelan government, as well as, political prisoners, as well as the operation of, rampant criminality with groups from the ELN to the sindicatos to various, armed prison gangs, so the so-called trenes, all continue to be part of the Venezuelan criminal landscape. And so a lot of things have not changed, although we do have at least some kind of superficial indications that people are talking about going eventually someday toward a more democratically legitimate government.
Similarly to contemptible is the Nicaragua government, which has declared the death of democracy. There are new sanctions. How?
There is a new proposed measure that was introduced by Senator Ted Cruz on the Republican side and co-sponsored by Tim Kaine. It's I believe it's 5362. It's currently in committee. But basically what it would do is it would extend some of the previous broad sanctions under what is known as the NICA Act, and later modernized through something called RENACER, to extend more broadly, going all the way out to 2035. Versus the NICA Act, which expires this year. It would extend those sanctions to those who are operating in Nicaragua's gold sector, which, including the Chinese, who now have concessions for 8% of Venezuelan's territory in the gold sector. That's one of the biggest hard currency earning organizations for the Ortegas. It would actually allow the designation of other strategic sectors, and it would begin to go after the Venezuelan military, some of their military economic activities. So sending a message to the Venezuelan, the Nicaraguan military that some of their institutional economic prerogatives may be at risk. And so, again, right now, it's just a bill that would significantly strengthen, but also create a path for undoing these sanctions if there's a return to democracy. But it's an indication that at least there's bipartisan consensus in Congress that more pressure needs to be put on the Ortegas for their continuing authoritarianism. That this is certainly on the minds and under the option of those in Congress who care deeply about Nicaraguan democracy in the hemisphere.
Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College, a Strategic Studies Institute looking at the Americas. On the eve of El Nino, I remind all of us that El Nino is a phenomenon of 3 to 7 years gaps. What is unusual now is that the meteorologists are saying this El Nino is likely to be very severe. We've had severe ones before that have done a lot of damage to the continents. This one, so far, is unprecedentedly severe, having to do with the warming of the Pacific, and that will certainly change our reporting over these next 16, 18 months. Professor Evan Ellis, U.S. Army War College, I'm John Batchelor.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and you know what's more American than America's 250th birthday? Supporting American-owned companies like SpinQuest, America's number one social casino with over 1,000 games like Live Dealer Blackjack and Craps. They're offering new users a $30 coin package for just $10. Go to SpinQuest.com and sign up today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.